There is a common misconception throughout the world, generally speaking, that to live the religious life means to be solemn, almost to be miserable, to abjure true happiness. Nothing could be further from the truth. Consider the body when it is healthy is a happy body. So too is it with the mind. If and when the mind is healthy, there is true happiness. The healthy body is one in which the pleasure-pain mechanism of the body is highly sensitive and functions freely. Under such conditions, the body is truly happy. And one of the peculiar characteristics of that happy state is that one is not specially conscious of it. One takes it for granted, so to say. One is actually living it. Now, in the case of the mind, corresponding to the pleasure-pain mechanism of the body, there is a joy-sorrow mechanism of the mind. If the mind is healthy, that joy-sorrow mechanism functions perfectly. Now note carefully, this does not mean that one chases any sort of sensational excitement or desires such and such joys. Because if that is the case, then physically one is anxious about avoiding pain, and psychically of doing away with the sorrow aspect in the psyche. In other words, there is attachment to pleasure and joy and aversion from pain and sorrow. It is this attachment and aversion which produces the conflict. The mechanism of body and psyche in terms of pleasure, pain, and joy, sorrow, has to function freely. What do I mean by the sorrow mechanism of the psyche? The sensitivity to suffering, to whatever is unhealthy, wheresoever it is, not just within oneself or in a particular person, but wheresoever it is, there is sensitivity to that. But if there is real sensitivity and an intelligent approach, one doesn't try to push it aside or get rid of it. If one tries to take sides like that, one will always produce or fall into another situation of conflict. The healthy mind is the balanced mind. It takes everything in its stride. It is free from attachment and aversion. It is free from making choices in favor of joy and against sorrow. When that is the case, then there is true happiness, something which we never know until there is freedom from chasing sensational excitement and chasing any sort of pleasures as such. This is not at all easy. It's extremely difficult. It's ingrained in us. One has to be extremely observant in order to be free of this vain chase. True happiness is something which is natural, constitutive of the mind. Just as the healthy body is a happy body, and we are more or less unconscious of the nature of that happiness. We just say, oh, I'm feeling fine. I'm very well, thank you. So too it is with the mind. This thing which is happiness is a characteristic of the healthy mind, that's all. When conflict, when ill conditions are out of the mind, the dirt is out of the mind, so to say, the mind is clean, it is happy. That is all. We don't have to chase happiness. Why do we chase happiness? Partly because it is our desire to grasp at what we believe is good for us. We enjoy it. We take pleasure in it, delight in it. And that is a sensational delight, quite different from true happiness. Sensational delight. That is one reason. The other reason, which is usually, perhaps in all cases, the more powerful reason, is that it is because our attempt to grasp this, that, or the other was frustrated. Where greed is frustrated, there is resentment stored up, and an unhealthy passion to compensate for it, to make up for it, to get it somehow, somewhere, in some way. These are amongst the main factors operating in this grasping after happiness, miscalled happiness. Actually, we identify happiness with the passing sensation of pleasure, whether it be purely physical pleasure, a physical sensation, or whether it be a psychical state. This passing sensation, this pleasurable feeling, has nothing to do with true happiness. But this is our illusion that it is happiness. Here, of course, we are up against a difficulty. I used the word joy when I talked of joy-sorrow mechanism of the psyche, and I used the word happiness. If one looks at a dictionary, of course, joy, happiness, they are all synonymous, aren't they? Even pleasure is equated with happiness and so forth. And because we are accustomed to regard them as synonymous, we use these words as we please. But the actual fact underlying our use of the words is our association of joy, pleasure, and happiness, and so on, with pleasurable sensations, whether physical or mental. So I am more or less arbitrarily defining joy in one way, happiness in this other way. The pleasurable psychical feeling, sensation, that's the joy mechanism of the psyche. And the unpleasant feeling, the annoyance, the sense of frustration, the feeling miserable and so forth, is the sorrow part of the mechanism. But this mechanism is highly sensitive when the mind is healthy. And that healthy mind, with this joy-sorrow mechanism functioning perfectly, that healthy mind is the happy mind. So, happiness must never be pursued. It will be there. It is there. It has only to be allowed to emerge by itself, by understanding the psyche. An understanding which is not just an analytical, critical examination for a day, a month, a year, or a 5-year course under a psychiatrist or somebody. It's not just that. It is the constant awareness, the constant observation of the mental processes throughout the day. That is essential. If there is that, and if one knows how to respond rightly to that mindfulness, then the mind remains in a state of balance and harmony. Anger may uprise. The feeling of envy may come in. One can become conscious of the drive of one's ambitions, one's desire to do good, to be helpful, to be kindly, and all the rest of it. And if one really observes and understands exactly what it is, and remains calm and balanced, then there is a state of happiness, a state of health in the organ, in the mind. This no one can take away from you, because it constitutes your mind. With the body, somebody can, if he's violent enough and strong enough, he can tear out my gizzards, can't he? Like a beast of prey could, if he jumped on me and did so. But such a situation apart, where the mind is concerned, no one can do it. You know, this is very important. Human beings the world over seek bodily health, bodily well-being. They understand that this belongs to the body, health and strength, right? So they go for it. They can achieve something in that direction. On the mental side, they chase happiness. They go for happiness, mistaking it for pleasurable sensation. And this they never realize. This which we call health, well-being in the body, is constitutive of the body which lives rightly physically. If one does the wrong things physically, well, of course, there will be ill health, apart from accidents and so forth. One is born, perhaps, with some unhappy defect. Well, then one can't help it. That is different. So let us clearly understand that this thing, happiness, which we seek, cannot be sought. It really cannot be sought. Similarly with peace of mind. Peace of mind cannot be sought. By being mindful and understanding the processes of the mind as they go on, and being utterly free from grasping at this, that, or the other, the mind remains at peace, healthy, happy. See, this is where the real discipline comes in. In the process of self-cleansing through self-understanding. And in order to be observant of oneself, one has to remain still, quiet. One of the reasons why in the discipline of yoga, for instance, on the physical side, we practice certain asanas and remain in them steadily, is that by doing so, we can awaken to the significance of stillness and quietness. But a real quietness, not a holding the body and similarly in the mental sphere, the mind, forcibly quiet. So you get, in that case, you get strained. You're not at ease. But body and mind have to be at ease in the process. So the self-observation must be an observation at ease, in ease. That is why. Let there be quietness. Don't let the mind go through a ding-dong battle of ideas, pros and cons, and so forth. Just observe, without criticizing. That is to say, passing condemnatory judgment, or a judgment which is an approval. Neither approving nor disapproving. Which will imply not coming to conclusions too. Every belief, every conclusion we come to is a stoppage, an endpoint, a block, a fixation. But the living creature, in the as it's the living process, the life process of the living creature never stops. It goes on continuously. My breathing, my bloodstream, my heart, liver, kidneys, everything is in continuous activity, a harmonious activity. Now our self-observation has to be of the same sort. You see the importance of not taking sides. When self-observation is going on, there is a judgment formed. Oh, this is bad. Then there is a resistance against it. I must get rid of it. There is a conflict. Or, if one observes and says, ah, this is good, then there is a stoppage. I must keep it. But if you keep the good, it will never get better. Whatsoever you grasp, whatsoever you stop moving, stagnates, comes to an end. Let it go on. That is to say, let the observation just go on quietly. Watch all the hidden resentments, frustrations, and so on, which come up and are given all sorts of verbal forms by the intellect, pros and cons, and this, that and the other. Don't worry about those pros and cons. Just observe that this is what the mind is doing and let it flow past. This is very difficult. When one does that, or when one can do that, then one ceases making the same mistake again and again, each time in a more intense form. Time and again, I have put this out. Why do we take to religion? And if we can look really clearly inside ourselves, we will see that it is because we want to compensate for our frustrations. That's why. It is not truly natural to us, truly spontaneous. It may be part of the way to spontaneity and naturalness, but it is not wholly spontaneous and natural. Right inside us, we are hoping to get some desirable, some satisfactory result. When I say we, I'm referring to this existential being, the body-mind, which comes into being, lives its life, and perishes completely and utterly as that particular existential being. Completely goes. Because this existential being is only a tiny little part and parcel of the total process. And there is nothing, no manifested thing in the total process which can escape death, extinction of itself as that self. This is a terrible thing to understand and to see. But if one really understands it, one will be completely free of all self-grasping. And then one begins to know the meaning of freedom. Then the mind is in the healthy state, the happy state. Those words, I and mine, are completely out of one's life. This is liberation, here and now. This is the peak point of Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, any, or Sufi, or any other yoga, or mysticism. It's the peak point of it. It is the real liberation. But it is very difficult. We can easily get self-deceived, that, oh, I'm free of this, I do not grasp that. But watch, watch, watch. Let a sufficiently provocative circumstance come, and one falls. The most graceful walker in the world is sure to stumble on the pavement someday, somewhere. Now you may wonder, why have I been talking so much about this business of happiness? The great teachers have pointed out very clearly, it is only the happy man the happy person, who can really be attentive to transcendence, to the real. When one is in the truly happy state, bodily and mentally, one is in the impassible state, P-A-S-S-I-B-L-E, the impassible state, the state which cannot be disturbed by pleasure or pain. Now try and really feel this out carefully. All the pain that the mind has suffered in life, all the illness of the mind, is there inside us all the time. It isn't out. All the nice things are also there inside us. If we sit down to meditate in the deep sense of the term, these two conflicting elements, the pleasurable and the miserable, they begin to emerge into consciousness and play havoc with consciousness. If we succeed in forcibly directing our attention to, say, some profound subject of meditation, assuming it is truly profound, we liberate mental forces which intensify both the good and the bad. See, people have often talked of the dangers of meditation. They have never explained why and how. Haven't explained sufficiently clearly, that is. We are liberating force, power, energy, mental energy. That energy intensifies both aspects. But if the person is really a happy person, bodily and mentally, he is impassible. He is not subject to the uprising of the pleasurable and painful sensations, physical or mental, which can interfere with his meditation. He is the person who can realize samadhi. Now, where the mind is concerned, what is the essential, the fundamental essential? Freedom from grasping. Note very carefully, this freedom from grasping, this simple phrase, includes everything. The Buddha said openly to his beloved disciple, Ananda. Ananda, his cousin, who was always near him. Freedom from grasping, O Ananda, is the realization of supreme Nibbana. He doesn't just say Nibbana. He says parinibbayati. That is the word he uses. The supreme Nirvana is his who is free from all grasping. Merely intellectually determining to give up this, that or the other is no use at all. It just produces conflict. But seeing, actually seeing clearly that everything, whether it be material, aesthetic, intellectual, whatever it is perishing. It arises, it has its little spell in space and time and then passes away. If one really sees that with that inward seeing, not just with the top layer of one's brain cells, then one can begin to refrain from grasping. Consider the simple fact. Why is it in our life when we have made one mistake in our teens, we repeat it in our 20s, we repeat it in our 30s and 40s and 50s, and we'll probably repeat it even in our graves. Why? This grasping, these tentacles which go out to get what I want and I desire. You see, the unhappy part of the story is that this is so deep in us, we are unconscious of it. We think, when we have suffered for the third time or fourth time from some awful mistake, we say to ourselves, my God, never again. We can't let 2 months slip by when we are at it again. Look at one of the saddest examples in our own day and age, in modern times, the drug addict. See what's happening. People say, oh, I'll take it this time, I won't do it again. Takes it this time. I've finished with it. 2 days later, he's taking it again. You just can't keep away from their mistakes. Then the mind, the intellect, will raise up a host of arguments why this should be done. See, the intellect, all too often, unfortunately, is hell's own agent. The devil's envoy extraordinary. Because the intellect is the slave of desire. That's why. We are so conceited, so proud of our intellects. Beware of this devil, the intellect. It's a very useful servant and an evil master. Notice the pride, obvious or deeply hidden, with which a man says, oh, I'm a hard-headed, objective-minded person. It's nothing of the sort. He's the slave of his desires, his irrationality. But he doesn't know it. Can we get free of grasping? See, the mind does this right in the unconscious depths all the time. It's doing this grasping, grasping, going after this, going after the other. Can we get free of grasping? And how? It cannot be done by any sort of violence on the mind. If we look at our own lives, we are constantly hurting ourselves as well as others. Constantly. And the Buddha himself said, he who lives without harming himself, without harming others, lives with a self, become Brahman, the ultimate reality, the supreme, the absolute. And you know, the Buddha was not lavish with his words, and certainly with his superlatives, but he said this, which is a supreme thing, just as the other statement to Ananda, freedom from grasping, all grasping, means the realization of supreme nirvana. And he also said, this is deathlessness, the freedom of the mind from all grasping. That is deathlessness. So now the Buddha said these words, if one lives without hurting others, without hurting oneself, both must be there. One lives with a self become Brahman. So can we be free from grasping? Because grasping lies at the root of hurting. There is little value in attempting to learn meditation and sit for 2 hours or 20 hours a day and concentrate on a particular subject and all that. One can just go through all that ritual over and over again, and it's futile. The unhealthy mind doing the so-called heavenly thing actually performs a hellish thing. Can we be free from grasping? What is the basis of it? Again, mindfulness. Mindfulness is a 24-hour meditation all through the day. Being mindful, being awake, being alert, being quiet, silent, and observing without taking sides, just observing. And in that observation, see the true nature of that which is being observed, not only externally, but as it rises up within oneself. Now, this mindfulness, this 24-hour meditation, does not intensify both the evil and the good. It is a cleansing process. It frees oneself, provided the mindfulness is not spoiled by approvals and disapprovals and so forth. If a certain state of mind rises up in me, say I get angry or annoyed or some awful fantasy rises up, you see, it's no good my saying, oh, this is horrible, this is evil, I must out with it. The moment I do that, the whole value of that mindfulness is gone. I must just observe the fact, this has arisen. And this is how it arose. This was the stimulus. And this arose as a reaction from me because inside me there was such and such a repression, something frustrated, a stored up resentment, an ill will, or positively an ambition, a drive to assert myself, to aggrandize this petty little perishing thing called myself. All these are the forces at work. But then you see them not just as a string of words intellectually. You actually touch them with the mind. You are really minding the thing then. And that is the meaning of the word minding. Minding is not a case of looking at whatever you're looking at a distance, separate from you. Just as the physical hand can actually touch an object and feel its texture, learn how to use it and all the rest of it, you see, so the mind has to touch what it is observing. Get hold of it that way. Of course, we could laugh at ourselves and say, but there's a magnificent example of the mind grasping the thing. But this is a different meaning of the word grasping. This understanding. The mind doesn't just keep apart and say, look at that and say, ah, this is good, this is bad. That's no use at all. Really get at one with it. Absorb it. You see, then the mind digests the whole experience and the whole observation. And it is out of that that the mind derives its health and grows and becomes free, becomes healthy and happy. So this process of minding is the important thing. Do try and feel this difference. Because if the whole organism, the psychophysical organism, doesn't feel it, it cannot get at one with it. And if it doesn't get at one with it, it always remains outside. And therefore, one is that much the less. One is incapable, remains incapable. See, this is one of the meanings of sensitivity. Sensitivity means really to take the thing into one's own being. Or if you like to put it the other way around, let one's own being become one with that which you are observing. This is quite a different thing. You see, this self-protective instinct against any sort of pain. No, I can't. I won't touch it. It hurts. No, you can't do it that way, you know. Everyone wants nice sugar-coated pills. It's not the sugar in the it's not the sugar coating that does the curing. It's the other part, the non-sugary part that does it. And you can't try to sugarcoat the psychical pill. You've got to take it in its wholeness as it is. So, being mindful in the right way, really minding the thing. I'm keeping on repeating this because, you know, these things don't really get home. They don't get really understood. Otherwise, there is a transformation today, now, if one really got it. And one sees the effects of the transformation in the way the person behaves, talks, exchanges ideas, and all the rest of it. All this is a revelation of the person. So, mind it that way. And this mindfulness, pure mindfulness, bare attention, if you like, does not intensify the evil in one. This mindfulness is an indispensable preparation. A preparation which can have a beginning, but it has no ending. Do not feel that it is a job which I shall finish after a year's practice or 10 years' practice. One never finishes this job. Why? The mind is not an inanimate object. The process of the mind is not a temporary process in order to turn out at the other end of the when it is over, the particular finished article, there you are, there's the article, now you can put it on your table or mantelpiece for the rest of your life. It's not like that. The mind is like the body. The living process is a continuous process. Let the living process cease in the body, and we all know that we'll be dead. But it's the same with the mind. the mental bloodstream and heart and liver and kidneys and everything have to go on functioning continuously, doing their job. So this mindfulness has to be continuous. And it must be completely open. The body ceases to grow after a certain period and then maintains itself for such a length of time and then inevitably undergoes its decline and one is dead. The body is dead. With the mind it is different. There are no beauty parlors for the mind, but the intelligent one who knows how to be mindful remains, or shall I say, becomes younger and more vigorous and youthful in mind every day. That mind is alive, it is vital, it becomes innocent. And in that state of innocence, not harming, innocens, not harming state, it is the pure mind, which can remain in the state of mindfulness all the time. But the essential condition, do not look for the result. Do not desire a result even. This purification of the mind through mindfulness is the basic preparation which enables us to get free of grasping. And remember that the preparation never ends. You're constantly in the preparation state. That's why I have said again and again, the first step is the one and only step. That doesn't mean that you stop. You're constantly taking the first step only. Constantly. Because the whole movement towards the fruition of man is here now. From here now to here now. Not there. If it is a there, then we are in the finite sphere of time and space. But where the religious fulfillment of man is concerned, and man essentially is a religious being, it is a fulfillment in terms of eternity, in terms of what does not begin. Whatsoever begins dies. Therefore, it is a fulfillment in terms of immortality. Now you can see the deeper metaphysical significance, if you like to call it so, of non-grasping. Whatsoever can be grasped is a limited, finite object, something which begins and dies, belongs to the realm of mortality. But that which is the immortal cannot be grasped. It is there, that is all. And it is for us human beings to realize that sort of thing. That is one of the deep purposes of our existence on the globe. That each one of us shall realize this and see it for ourselves. What happens when we do see it for ourselves? The person becomes the instrument of extraordinary energies. I say energies, but I should actually say energy. Energy which belongs to a realm which is immeasurable. It has no dimensions. The realm of the immortal, which has no beginning or ending, has no length or breadth or depth. Nothing which you can measure, whatsoever can be measured, is limited. Comes under the lordship of the Lord of Death. It is the realm of the immeasurable, the infinite, the non-finite in the real sense. These are not vain intellectual speculations. They are facts, for the very simple reason that whosoever realizes anything like this becomes transformed thereby in his inner nature. He becomes transformed in his inner nature. I, as I am in the outer world, as an existential being, can control the energies of the world because they are finite, they are measurable. Energies like heat, electricity, and so forth, I can control, and I can make them do my will. I can make machines and so forth and make them do my will. In the finite world, the world of conflict, of mortality, of suffering, and all the rest of it, this existential being can do that. But I cannot control or make the infinite do my will. See, that does unto me, even as it does unto every one of us throughout the world. And not one of us can either say yea or nay to that infinite, eternal, immortal. That is the meaning of the word God, of Brahman, of Atma. That is the meaning of that which is the not made, the not born, the not become. Therefore you see at once, it is the inconceivable. But the human being is so constituted that he, as the living existent, can be the apparatus, the vehicle through which this transcendent energy functions. And if there is the mindfulness and the preparation and the freedom from grasping, then the true deep meditation can begin, by which in the stillness those incredible forces play through the mortal. And you have to be a happy being before you can put yourself into that position of stillness where those energies will operate. And that is another purpose, if you like, of our existence in the world. We have seen a process which we scientifically call evolution, or we may call it emergence, if you like. What characterizes this evolution and emergence? Amongst other things, one of its principal characteristics is this, that the organisms which come into being are more and more complex, not complicated, more and more complex, and they are more and more sensitive to things to which less sensitive organisms, less complex, less developed organisms are not sensitive. You and I can be sensitive to the deeps of intellectual achievement, to aesthetic things, to spiritual realities, to deep profundities. We can respond as we are now, in our little way. But can my dog do that? Can an elephant do that? Nice little jumbo that he is. He can't. But you and I can. It is in our organism. And this is nature's work, remember. Nature's work, as we call it, we haven't even a fraction of a conception of what that word nature really means. Nature's work produced this organism. And in this organism, on this planet, Mother Earth, this phenomenon can take place. Which means that there is energy of a nature which is utterly different from what we know and we can control. And when one has come to this happy state, this purified condition, this condition which enables us to be free from repeating our errors over and over again, then sit still, let the mind be quiet, and those transcendent power, that transcendent power begins to operate, and you'll know it. This is a fact, simple fact. Consider, can any one of us exist apart from what we call the not-self? If there were no desert sands, no stones, no trees, no soil, no animals, no insects, no viruses and bacteria. And we've got hosts of bacteria inside us, remember? Otherwise we wouldn't be healthy. You see? And so forth. No animals. Would we exist? If there were no air and light and sun, cosmic radiations, electrical forces, gravitational forces in operation, could any one of us exist? And this total cosmos brings each one of us into being. This total cosmos brings every single atom and the intra-atomic particles into being. You see, one has to awake to this. Don't try to meditate too deeply on this, because as I say, this is one of those meditations which intensifies. It's a terrific thing. It intensifies everything inside you. Just take it at the intellectual level as an idea and leave it at that until there is inward purification. Otherwise, all kinds of terrible results could come out in the psyche. But this is a fact, isn't it? Which we can see scientifically, intellectually, understand and appreciate. The total cosmos brought this into being. This living existence will be such for its little spell, 60, 70, well, I can't say 60 because I'm more than 70, 80, 90 years maybe, and then this living existence manifest as this will completely disappear. But the cosmos will never be more nor less because of or despite this living existence. That puts me into perspective with respect to the cosmos, doesn't it? You see? And yet if the whole cosmos has brought this into being, this has its place in the cosmos, its purpose in the cosmos, its meaning in the cosmos. Don't merely seek it as an intellectual presentation. What is the meaning? What is the purpose of my existence? And the Lord God said, Feroz, the purpose of your existence is so and so, X, Y, Z. And I say, oh, thank you, Lord, that's awfully kind of you. And then I go on, absolutely not fulfilling any purpose. But that's what we do, isn't it? Now, mindfulness. Through mindfulness, happiness. Not as something which you will get. Because happiness is part of your constitution. You can't get part of your constitution. There's my nose. I can't go and get a nose. It's there. And very visible too. See, all right, it is there. Happiness is there. The happy person. The quiet person. Have you looked at flowers, clouds, birds? Have you watched a worm moving along? How have you watched it? Next time you look, see it as wholly expressing the purpose of its existence. A bird, a worm, a flower has not my power willfully to cooperate or not to cooperate. It just is in tune with the cosmos, unconsciously, unknowingly. Hence its limitations. Its sensitivities are very much less than yours and mine. And therefore, it just automatically almost fulfills the purpose of its existence. But you and I were brought into being by nature to fulfill something far profounder. We have the power to look within and to make the withinness knowingly be in tune with the cosmos. And to be knowingly in tune with the cosmos means that this existent being who willfully asserts his separateness from the cosmos shall cease to assert that separateness. And really to see, to touch with his whole being, his mind and his heart and his body, the complete relationship with the cosmos. And the basis of this is the one basis of absolute purity. You cannot get away from that. And purity means not seeking anything for the self. When we are truly selfless, when we have truly seen this kind of thing, we have no problems. Now please don't misunderstand me. Difficulties, awkward situations, pain, pleasure, success, failure, everything will come our way just as it comes the way of anybody else. But they will not be problems for us. A problem means a self out of joint with the environment, etc., in terms of his own awareness of the situation. If some epidemic breaks out and I go down under it, say influenza epidemic comes along and I go down under it, well, of course I'm out of joint, you see, but I'm not resisting that out of jointness. Now do you understand? I see that it is there. I know that it will pass away. In one form or other, one form will entail the survival of this existent being. The other form entail the death of this existent being. One of those two situations will occur. Those are the two main situations. Of course, one may just survive and be very much weakened and all that, but no need to go into details like that. You understand what I'm getting at. You see, I am physically out of joint, in fact, as such, but in my own awareness, I understand. So the relationship is a relationship of harmony. The self and the not-self are not in conflict with each other inside the mind. Do you get it? Now you see, that means I have no problem when I'm suffering from this influenza. On the other hand, if I have the misfortune to win the pools and get £300,000 or whatever it is, you see, and I have this understanding and this freedom from grasping, I have no problem, although the £300,000 in my possession will bring an awful lot of what the world would in the ordinary way call trouble. Make no mistake about it, if you suddenly get a vast fortune planted on you, you'll know the misery of it all. This is a fact. So, the person who has really ceased to grasp, who is really mindful, is happy, he is healthy, he is free of problems, come what may. Pleasure, pain, success, failure. Makes no difference. Now you see, what happens then? In this living existent, you yourself, and through this living existent, you yourself, this transcendent energy begins to operate. You and I never know how it operates, never can know with the brain. Quite impossible. We are only aware, perhaps at times, that yes, it is operating. Don't try to peer into the secret and find it out. It will unhinge the mind if you do. You know, sometimes in these meetings I have said, my great concern is for your happiness. Do you understand that? That word happiness must not be defined in terms of success, of pleasure, and worst of all, the fulfillment of desires, the gratification of desires. No. That is what hinders. Those are the forces of death, the destroyer. And the cosmos says the time has come, this doesn't do, this is no good, and just a dust afterwards, floating through the long grey glooms of time. Literally so. But the one who sees, yes, through him, the immanent and the transcendent are one. The self and the not-self are one. And in that is the fulfillment. Not my fulfillment or your fulfillment, but the fulfillment of the totality. That is the state of bliss. Something which the mind never knows. So, be happy. don't chase happiness.